Hello, listeners. The Party Podcast is more than just a podcast. It's a platform where academia meets real-world narratives, where rigid policy frameworks are juxtaposed against human experience. Here, we don't just dissect global issues. We humanize them, we narrate them, and we invite you to join us in reimagining a world where policy is not just about governance, but about understanding and nurturing the human spirit that drives the essence of global interactions. We are a podcast founded within the Boston University Party School of Global Affairs community. Feel free to explore the Party Atlas page to check out other graduate student content at Boston University. Welcome back, everybody, to episode 4 of the Party Podcast. Today we have Greta Peis, who is a BU alumni who currently works for the World Bank as a consultant. Greta, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Carl. It's a pleasure.
Something I always find interesting is asking, as a former athlete myself, I always like to ask people who also have an athletic background, kind of how their passion and dedication to their sport, in your case, alpine skiing, influence your approach to academics and personal challenges. I know sports can play a big role in personal development, but I'm always curious to see how the lessons you've learned from alpine skiing kind of transitioned into your academic pursuits.
Yeah, I'm more than happy to talk about it, and I'm glad to hear that you also have an athletic background. Well, I would say that alpine skiing has overall made me stronger, but I want to be also more specific about it. It has taught me three things: discipline, resilience, and patience. When it comes to discipline, we used to wake up very early in the morning around 4 or 5 a.m. to either go training or racing. And I've kept waking up early since then. I feel like I'm mostly productive in the mornings. And when I was in school, I would always try to get ahead of things, do my homework, prepare for class even before going to class. So I've kept that discipline. Resilience, in sports, like in school, you don't always win. There are times when you lose or you don't perform at your best as you would like to, right? And initially, it was really challenging for me to accept that, to accept the fact that I was not performing at my best. But eventually, skiing has taught me to acknowledge the fact that I've given it all, I've given it my best, and the fact that there is margin for improvement is actually a motivating factor, right? It will drive me forward to become a better version of myself on a daily basis. And then that will lead me to my next point, which is patience. Things don't happen from one day to the other. They take time, sometimes years, right? When I was trying to perfect my technique while skiing, I really understood that that was going to take time. And ultimately, even when we're in school and we're trying to perform better, gain a knowledge and skills, it takes a time. Those are the things that skiing taught me.
Absolutely. I mean, I have some very similar learning experiences. I often complain about having to wake up for 8 a.m. practice in college, but considering you woke up at 4, I think I should probably stop complaining about that. But yeah, it's always nice to hear. Athletes sometimes get lumped into a box of being just athletes, and it's always nice to hear athletes venturing off and doing other things and pursuing more intellectual pursuits as opposed to just physical. And I think those lessons definitely carry over. So you mentioned that in your transition from skiing, you kind of have carried some of those factors, those lessons that you've learned along into your academic pursuits. So transitioning to your academic pursuits, what drove you towards international relations and economics?
So it's been a self-discovery type of journey because I'm a first-generation student. And to be honest, Carl, initially I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. And the reason why I chose economics was purely practical. Even after talking to my parents, they were like, yeah, you should go for economics first. Because that's going to open up doors after you graduate, You could be working in a variety of fields, right? So I was not thinking about international relations right away. I started off with econ, but there was this gut feeling in me that was telling me to step out of my comfort zone and learn a new language, which is when I decided to move to Moscow. Because of my Slavic background, I'm Slovak Italian, and I wanted to leverage that Slavic background to learn a language that was more difficult than European languages, because the other option was going to be French. And it was a very enriching experience at the time that I spent in Moscow. I was not expecting to meet that many people from different backgrounds. So I was in this dormitory living with Russians, but also people from the Middle East and Central Asia. And I really got exposed there to international affairs, right? And so from there, I thought to myself, well, after I'm going to be done with my undergraduate degree, I really want to learn more about international affairs while continuing to study econ. And that's how I decided to then to continue pursuing my master's at Boston University, where I graduated in international relations, specializing in global economic affairs.
That is, I don't want to say similar to my story, because yours sounds a little more interesting than mine, but I had different plans going into college, and then slowly started to realize that international affairs was probably more up my alley. I was thinking law school at first, but the more and more I studied international affairs, the more and more I got drawn to it. So, you know, some people are interested in it their whole lives. And then some people, you know, it's through some kind of self-discovery. So
exactly.
You've mentioned that. So your journey has kind of taken you from Italy to Moscow. And then you mentioned your Slavic background and then to Boston University. So are there any experiences or interactions that were pivotal in shaping your interests?
Yes, I would say so. But so I was mentioning that I lived in this dormitory in Moscow, right? And I became close friends with a group of guys and girls from the Middle East. And when the pandemic broke out, we all decided to stick together in the dormitory. We didn't leave for our home countries. And we would cook a lot together, and then we would hang and have dinners, right? And during those dinners, we would have conversations about all sorts of topics, so from culture to art and history. And I remember there was this time when we were talking about living standards in our respective countries, as well as socioeconomic development, national security, etc. Right, and I remember being told by one of my friends that what they were saying was something that I was not fully going to be able to comprehend because I was from the West. And that really struck me, to be honest, but in a positive way, in the sense that I didn't get offended, but instead I started, wondering what it was that I knew about their country, their history, their living standards. And I felt almost compelled to learn more because I felt like there was a divide between us, right? And a significant divide at the international level, because oftentimes we don't fully understand the complexities behind the global issues. And so I felt compelled to learn more about international affairs. And that's how I then decided to apply for my master's at BU. So that was pivotal, that dinner specifically.
That sounds like an amazing experience. And two, there's a lot of topics that aren't typically covered at dinner amongst friends in college. So it's always interesting to hear how people and their experiences and their environment shape the kind of conversations that they have. And it sounds like it was obviously very, very rewarding. So how have these conversations and kind of your journey living in different places impacted or contributed to your understanding of global development?
Well, I would say that first of all, by living and working in different countries, I understood how complex a global development is in the first place. And I don't want it to sound naive, right? Because we all know how complicated global issues are, Something that I would add is that by interfacing with people from Ensemble and talking about the global challenges, I understood that it's really important to be active listeners, to truly understand other points of view and to be able to put yourself in somebody else's shoes, right? So when you're debating upon topics, of course, you want to be able to share your opinion, but you really want to be also able to listen to what someone else has to say, especially when it comes then to, you know, professional settings and you have to solve challenges. So this has been the biggest lesson I've learned, I think, by living in different places.
Yeah, absolutely. Something I found lacking throughout my academic journey was kind of this difference of not only difference of opinion, but difference of culture or difference of perspectives on the world that I think really, in hearing those, you create a more well-balanced version of yourself and you're able to understand others better. Something I feel like that's lacking significantly in some other programs I've been involved in is feels like kind of a echo chamber of ideas that you already have.
Right.
And they reaffirm your beliefs and, you know, constantly challenging your beliefs and finding new ways to justify them and understanding where other people are coming from is extremely important. So what inspired you to choose these specific case studies and kind of what were your key findings?
Thank you. I'm more than happy to talk about my thesis because it was a really overwhelming but rewarding process. So to address your first question, why Benin and Cameroon? But honestly, I will be very transparent with you. I set myself over very high expectations at the beginning, in the sense that I wanted to look at the entire sub-Saharan Africa. But I realized that first of all, collecting the data that I needed was going to be very challenging. There were a lot of missing data points that I had to go out and collect myself in the end. And then second of all, I was a full-time student taking other classes while I was writing my thesis. And I was also working two jobs. And so in the end, I had to lower my expectations by, choosing three countries that we were discussing with my academic advisor to focus my research on, right? And I happen to have more data points for Benin and Cameroon. So that's why I focused on them. And I investigated just to give you a little bit of context, the evolution of electrification patterns in relation to regional investments in electricity proxied by power plants, location, and ownership. And by combining data on electricity access and sources of electrical power units, I analyzed how different institutions may have contributed to expanding electrification over time and across the space in these countries. And I paid particular attention to EU-owned power sources, given that Benin and Cameroon are part of something called the CFA franc zone, which is an economic and monetary union with the EU. And my findings suggest that the type of ownership of power sources by different entities, I was looking at domestic government-owned sources on one side and private sector sources on the other, was not always associated with improved access to electricity. In Benin, households living closer to state-owned power plants were no more or less likely to receive electricity than households living in proximity of private firm-owned electrical units. However, in Cameroon, rural households that lived closer to power supplied by investments from developing financial institutions had a higher likelihood of accessing electricity. And I thought that was a really interesting finding, given the importance of development agencies and development financial institutions in these settings.
Yeah, wow, that sounds extremely interesting and extremely quantitative, a little bit beyond my expertise, but I can at least relate to the part about biting off more than you can chew and having to narrow it down. As I'm writing my thesis, I'm running into the same things where I'm asking myself more qualitative questions that are very interesting to me, but unfortunately the data is or the evidence, I should say, is kind of inaccessible. So
I feel you. It is hard, honestly. It is hard. I remember this time I reached out to this organization, a private company, to access their database. I mean, to inquire about the possibility of accessing their database, right? Because they seem to have exactly what I was looking for. And they said, yes, as long as I was going to be able to pay for $12,000. I was like, where am I going to find, you know, the money to pay for this? And in the end, I just gave up and I changed a few things, the approach, and a few other things. So, but yeah, it's hard. I understand.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it goes back to, you know, the lessons you learned in sports, right? Is that you set expectations very high for yourself, and then sometimes you realize they're a little bit too high and you need to dial them back and make them a little bit more realistic and achievable. And then hopefully someday you can get access to the kind of things you need to make a more comprehensive outlook on things. During your research and writing your thesis, I'm curious to know what was kind of the distribution of kind of clean energy versus fossil fuels? Do these countries seem to still be heavily reliant on fossil fuels, or are they starting to transition towards clean energy? And how do you see the role of clean energy evolving in sub-Saharan Africa?
Thank you. This is a really good question, and I'm happy to talk about it. So I observed that in my research that both countries were still mostly reliant on fossil fuels, right? So the energy mix was, in the energy mix, fossil fuels were predominant relative to cleaner energy like solar. However, I did observe that solar is slowly taking hold of. For example, I found out about this French company, which recently, a few years ago, started implementing PV technologies in Benin. But other than that company, I haven't seen other ones. And so when it comes to EU investments to target electricity access in the region, I think we're still low. Falling behind, especially in light of the Sustainable Development Goal of achieving universal access to electricity by 2030. I'm hoping we're going to see more investments in the future, but I think a lot of that has to do with factors that are not completely under international investors' control. And by that, I mean, if we're looking at the grids in developing countries, they are beset with three main problems. So first of all, electricity theft. Then the fact that customers cannot always meet the cost of electricity because of their low purchasing power. And also underdeveloped billing systems. So those are also factors to be taken into account. But if we can come together and address this issue, then I think that we're also going to see more investments in PV technologies, especially since sub-Saharan Africa has a lot of potential for concentrating solar energy, right? But something that I would like to add is, relating to the grids, there's another way to pre-electrify your remote areas in sub-Saharan Africa. So without having to necessarily address those challenges related to the grid, which may be logistically challenging and capital intensive, a lot of discussions have been revolving around distributed energy resources, shortened DERs, which are small modular energy generation and storage technologies that provide electric capacity or energy where needed. And the good thing about them is that they can be standalone systems. So they don't need to be necessarily connected to the grid in order to provide electricity to households, but they can function on their own. And so this technology has been a breakthrough in developing settings to pre-electrify remote areas where it would be, again, logistically and capital intensive to extend the grid there.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah, thank you. That was fantastic. And I'd like to talk a little bit about your professional career now. So I know that you're now a consultant for the World Bank's poverty and equity team. Can you explain what that is and kind of what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So at the World Bank, I am the primary consultant on multiple country level projects. So far, I have worked with Colombia specifically, so a lot in America. And we use our in-house built methodology called SWIFT to analyze wide-scale surveys that we then use to evaluate poverty and consumption rates of that country. And so what this means essentially is that I am provided with surveys that were collected on the ground by our local partners. And then I'm supposed to clean and harmonize that data to turn it into coding samples. And then once I have that coding sample, I use it to estimate the poverty and consumption rates. And it's been a really challenging and rewarding process at the same time, because whenever I'm analyzing the data, I need to make sure that it's comparable to what has been done in the past by other consultants. When I observe data discrepancies, I need to understand why it is the case. Is it because there's a problem with my coding, or is it because on the ground our partners were not able to collect enough data because of conflicts that have arisen in the meantime, right? Or is it because respondents have misunderstood a certain question? So there are challenges to analyzing that data, but it's been interesting because I get to interact a lot with all sorts of colleagues and stakeholders to address those challenges and then come up with solutions to them.
Oh, that's awesome. Sounds like very intense, but also rewarding work. And you're giving me flashbacks to Professor Carr's quantitative analysis class, which I'm sure taught you some of the necessary skills that you needed to
absolutely, yes,
in order to thrive in this job. Shout out to him. I don't know if he's a listener or not, but yeah, that was a really good class. Kind of got me a lot more interested in the quantitative side, not necessarily up my alley, but definitely interesting to me. So you touched on it briefly, but what are kind of the challenges you face in turning quantitative data into actionable strategies for poverty alleviation and equity? Are there any specific stories that you can tell where a data-driven strategy led to noticeable improvement? I know that you just started, but you're kind of fresh in the job when it comes to your career. So if you don't have any stories, that's fine, but would love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to build off of what I just said when I was mentioning data challenges. I remember working on this project and observing data discrepancies in summary statistics when I was comparing the summary statistics for our variables of interest, specifically two of them. That was a stumbling block. I couldn't proceed with the analysis because I was observing those discrepancies, right? And so I spent a great amount of time understanding whether I got it wrong, whether I was coding something wrongly. But in the end, after reaching out to our colleagues and local partners, we started brainstorming why that was the problem that we were encountering, right? And I was told in the end that one of the questions had been misunderstood by respondents. It was about garbage collection. They thought that it was about something else that we were not talking about garbage collection, right? And so in the end, I had to drop that variable from my analysis, and typically we try to avoid the dropping variables for accuracy purposes. And then for the other variable, I remember that the problem was not that there had been a misunderstanding on the ground. Rather, our partners were not able to access certain areas of that had been accessed before because of conflicts. So they were not allowed to enter for security reasons, for safety reasons, sorry. And those were challenging times, honestly, because of it took a lot of time to figure out what was going on before moving forward. But it was also interesting for me to see and understand what are the challenges to analyzing data in development settings.
So you discussed some of the challenges you've encountered, including issues with data collection or people, misunderstanding what the question was specifically asking, or not being able to access communities for security and safety reasons. So kind of to make it a little more broad, what are some of the critical gaps in current global development strategies, and how can these gaps be addressed to better serve underprivileged communities in regards to things like healthcare, education, access to clean water, and maybe financial inclusion?
Thank you for your question. In my opinion, the biggest gap when it comes to global development and addressing global challenges is financing. We oftentimes hear about the financing gaps in relation to the Sustainable Development Goals that were adopted by 193 countries in 2015, right? And so the question is, how do we bridge those gaps? But just to give you some numbers here, according to a recent report that was published last July, 2023 by UNCTAD, developing countries face a staggering $4 trillion USD gap in sustainable development investments. And the thing is that there are sectors of the economy which are receiving more attention than others when it comes to investments, such as financial services, right? You mentioned financial inclusion, so that's great. Then we have agriculture and clean energy. Those are all great things. But then I think the challenge here is trying to even out that allocation of resources to sectors like education, for example, which is not receiving that much attention, at least according to the resources that I have. Therefore, I think moving forward, it is really imperative to identify strategies to pull together more resources for development and diversify SDG financing into underinvested sectors and geographies. I think something else that I would mention is the importance of being able to conduct the fieldwork by living in developing country for some time to really understand the complexities behind the challenges that locals face on the ground. And I feel that's not always easy, especially for entry-level positions, right? So entry-level professionals, I've encountered this quite several times now when I look at positions at fieldwork positions, they more often than not require you to have a ready fieldwork experience. Right. So I would hope moving forward to see more organizations prone to having young professionals enter the industry, right, and gain hands-on experience without necessarily having it already.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that we're probably going to end up working in two very separate fields, but I've come into encountered the same or similar problems, not necessarily with field work, but, experience. Mm-hmm. A lot of entry-level positions require experience that would be nearly impossible for a master's student to have, even if they did an internship every summer since their freshman year of college. So, that's definitely a difficult challenge. And I think
you bring up a really important point that, you know, while the quantitative stuff and the data is obviously very important, I think that, you know, there is a qualitative element of understanding the numbers that you need, the kind of hands-on experience, or you need to live in a location where you get the data from to really fully understand the issue. So, you know, obviously the quantitative side is very important and the qualitative side is important, but on their own, I think that, I don't want to say they're useless, but they're certainly missing something. So I think that, you know, you mentioning kind of bridging that gap and kind of combining the two together to create strategies that better serve underprivileged communities is a great observation.
And I have coined this term from a professor. I took this class on energy market dynamics last year with Professor Stubbe from Questrom, and he used the term positive feedback loops, which I love them, and I keep using it because essentially what that means is that, you know, we as professionals enter the field and engage with local communities to understand what their challenges are, how they would solve them, right? And once you tackle those needs in the first place, you're basically adopting a bottom-up approach to solving challenges instead of coming in and being the big guy. Well, maybe not the big guy, that's not the right term, but like, I think it is really important to avoid having a top-down approach. It's important to understand what the needs of the local communities are, and the fact that one approach may have worked somewhere doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work there where you're trying to implement it, which is why it is, again, important to engage with locals to create those positive feedback loops.
Absolutely. I feel like there are certain global institutions that have, I don't know if it's necessarily a well-founded kind of, will have this opinion of certain institutions. Yeah, I'm not sure how too well-founded it is, but it seems like people think that these institutions sort of come in with this top-down approach and say, without listening to what the locals, you know, want and their needs, and say, this is what you're going to do because we have proven that it works elsewhere. And I think that, you know, while at sometimes a top-down approach is good, you also need a bottom-up approach, and they kind of need to work together to meet somewhere kind of in the middle so that nobody gets excluded and everybody's opinions are valued.
Exactly.
Moving a little bit, it seems like we have become very, very reliant on technology. Mm-hmm. And technology has certainly, the rate at which technology has grown and expanded across the world, and its impact has certainly been felt. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how technology might work in to serve, better serve underprivileged communities. So especially in things that seem to not get a lot of attention, like education, using digital learning platforms, or in healthcare, for example. I was wondering if you see any of that in your work.
Thank you. Not necessarily in my work, at least so far, but recently, I have had the opportunity of meeting with professor, an economist and professor at MIT, Daron Acemoglu. I read his book, Power and Progress, which he wrote with Simon Johnson, who was also a professor at MIT. And the book essentially touches on the role of technology. It's not that it touches, actually. It is about the role of technology and of AI in a variety of settings, including development settings. A lot of what I'm going to say here is drawn from what I read in the book, which I strongly recommend you to read if you're interested in the topic. I think it is really well written and very insightful. So AI can be a double-edged sword. in any setting, Samba, including when it comes to deploying it for international development purposes. If it's used to prioritize automation and surveillance while failing to create new tasks and opportunities for workers, I think it poses a significant setback to global development. On the contrary, if technology was redirected to encourage the development of new tasks with the help of machine intelligence, it would augment human capabilities and also improve the productivity of workers in their current job. So in the context of education, for example, the book talks about how algorithmic advances can introduce new tasks, such as personalized teaching. And if we think about it, right, oftentimes we're put in a classroom, actually always, right? Students are put in a classroom, and they come from different backgrounds, but they may, some of them may have been exposed to certain topics already, so they're already ahead of the game, right? And other ones are not, specifically, most often than not, people who come from low socioeconomic backgrounds. So being able to support the students from low socioeconomic backgrounds with personalized teaching would help us to bridge socioeconomic gaps at a higher level. And this is what the book also points at. And I think it is extremely important. And a singular argument, holds for healthcare. Human complementary and human empowering technologies can empower nurses and healthcare professionals in primary care and in the prevention of diseases on a more ad hoc basis.
I mean, I think that, you know, I think about how far AI and kind of machine learning has come, and I just think of all these sort of applications, and maybe this is my ignorance, but I'm not sure if they're how well that, you know, these resources are being applied. I mean, when you think about healthcare, for example, you know, AI can help in diagnosing disease or kind of predicting outbreaks or optimizing resource allocation and kind of under-resourced regions. It extends to agriculture and education, as you mentioned. So this is another kind of forward-looking trend that, you know, is going to be exciting to see how this develops, especially in underserved and underprivileged communities. We talked for a little bit about how we can redirect technology towards helping reach development goals or furthering the development of underserved and underprivileged communities. I was wondering what other forms of redirection do you think are needed in the future of international collaboration for development?
Thank you. So I don't necessarily think that we need a new form, Samba, because we already have the 17 SDGs that were agreed upon, and they are the most universal blueprint that we have to tackle sustainable development today at the international level, right? But tackling it, I think, is both a major challenge and an opportunity. It is a challenge because to this day, there continues to be a significant socioeconomic gap among countries, driven by non-sustainable patterns of consumption and production in the global north, as it was stated in the Brundtland report in 1987. And while it is true that since then technological breakthroughs, so the opportunities, have paved the way for cleaner energy, solar, wind, and batteries are just the three examples, to reduce our carbon footprint and the depletion of resources, we are still, I think, far away from being able to meet the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And I believe that because I don't think technological advancements will be the only solution to sustainable development. I think something that is crucial is also behavioral changes. And what do I mean by that? I think that in the way we conduct our lifestyles, sometimes we can have a negative impact on the environment. So if we are making progress in one direction with technology, but we're not thinking about our actions, single actions. And I think it is going to be more challenging, right? Perhaps not impossible, but it will take more time to actually achieve sustainable development and ensure that we're not depleting resources for future generations. But then the question is, how do global leaders persuade their citizens, right, to change their lifestyles? I think some people may be more prone to it, but others are going to be more recalcitrant. And I think that's a challenge. So how do we get together, and how do we spread the importance of changing some features of our lifestyle?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, I don't want to make this a cultural issue or step in any kind of hot water in that regard, but I think that in my experience traveling to different parts of the world, I think that there are certainly some areas of the world that are more community focused, and I think you can start to see this idea of changing individual behavior for the collective good starting to take over, or at least it's always been there. And then in other areas, it's sort of the opposite.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge, but I think there's margin for improvement. We can also, again, as you said, I don't want to generalize it here, but I think it's important to acknowledge the fact that we're still seeing these differences, and it's important to address them moving forward, I think.
Okay. Throughout our conversation, something that kind of is a recurring theme, or at least kind of floats in the background, is diverse perspectives, diverse opinions, different upbringings, different cultures. In your work, what strategies have you found most effective for leveraging these diverse perspectives to address, some simpler and some more complex development challenges?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So I would say three strategies. The first one is understanding your personality. Second, develop your expertise. And third, avoid the so-called Einstein effect. And I'm going to explain more what that is in a second. So by understanding your personality, I mean thinking about how you come off to other people and how people respond to you. So in certain situations, if you think, for example, that you are easy to get upset when someone doesn't agree with you, you may think about, how you're going to behave in that particular scenario, right? But this is just an example. How are you going to behave in a whole bunch of scenarios to anticipate your reactions and ensure that you are contributing to a positive working environment? Second, develop your expertise and be confident about your skills and knowledge. Oftentimes, we discount ourselves from the very beginning, even before sharing our ideas, right? And that makes me think a lot about the imposter syndrome that a lot of us experience, right? But if we are in a certain setting, if we are working there, that means that we've done progress, we've done efforts to get there, and we should be owning that space and use it to showcase our knowledge and skills. And then third, I was mentioning the Einstellung effect. It's actually something I learned recently, and I thought to myself, wow, I didn't know it was called this way. It's essentially a problem-solving set that makes you stick to what you are already familiar with, because you're afraid to exploring other avenues and other ways of going about solving issues, right? But I think it is really important to experiment with new methods and strategies to address tasks and challenges. So looking at things from different perspectives and being open to changes and new solutions.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, if we're going to come together and solve some of the bigger issues facing our world, I think that, things that you have mentioned throughout our conversation, especially in that answer, are going to be very, very important to creating a, not only safe individual working environments, but also the global kind of collaborative effort to tackle some of these challenges. I want to transition a little bit into something, I guess, a little more personal. As a second year master's student, and definitely talking to a lot of my cohort and even some of the first year students, there's quite a cynical view of the world, but also kind of a sort of lack of guidance, if you will. So I was wondering, based on your experiences, both professional and academic and outside of that, I was wondering, what advice would you offer to, you know, people who are about to graduate or people who are thinking about getting into global development or international relations? What advice would you give them to somehow make an impactful contribution to the field?
Thank you. I'm happy to share my experience. And I have three pieces of advice. The first one is start early if you can, and I'll explain what I mean by if I can. But first of all, start early by engaging in community service in your town, joining advocacy groups and youth clubs, as well as looking for internship opportunities in the field. If you can, because at least in my experience, I often had to compromise on what I could have done versus what I had to do in order for me to be able to sustain myself economically. So I was, you know, working a ton of jobs that were not necessarily related to my field of studies, because I had to make ends meet, especially when I was here in Boston, right? It is such an expensive city. And so, you know, if you can find a time to build your curriculum outside of school, that is great to take those opportunities, but also don't feel like you're lagging behind if you can't in that moment. The opportunity will come your way. I am sure about that. It's just a matter of time sometimes. Second, build your network. Probably you've heard this a lot of times. Use your LinkedIn to showcase your skills and knowledge, but also to connect with professionals in the field. Don't be afraid of reaching out. Called emailing is a great instrument I think we have these days. But the worst thing that can happen is that they're not going to get back to you, or they're going to say that they don't have time. But always give it a chance. Put yourself out there and be your own advocate. And third, I would say don't be afraid of taking risks and stepping out of your comfort zone. But if you have the opportunity to spend some time in a country you're interested in, do that for sure. Embrace those challenges. They're going to be ups and downs, but ultimately, from both of them, you're going to learn a lot, and they're going to be great teaching experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. I like the focus on engaging with your local community. I feel as though sometimes, especially studying international affairs, we get caught up in the really, really big picture and the meta that's way up here that, you know, we want to solve all these issues. But, you know, starting in your local community, I mean, if we change kind of the way that we think about how we want to go about making an impact on the world, I think starting in your community is a great place where you can also, you know, it gives you motivation when you notice the difference that people are making. I know that international relations in your local community aren't necessarily the same thing, but I think that that's a great piece of advice, not only to serve your community, but also as kind of inspiration. So to kind of cap things off, you know, this podcast is more focused on the human perspective and bridging the gap between academics and the real world. And I like to ask our guests to share a story or an experience or something they've noticed through their work that the public might not necessarily be aware of, but something that's positive, hopeful. Sometimes it feels like all the news we read is super cynical about how bad things are, but I think that there are a lot of great people like you who are doing work behind the scenes that might not necessarily get noticed, but are actually making, you know, significant impacts in the real world. So I was wondering if you could share something either through work or something that you've learned recently in terms of global development that would serve as sort of inspiration or a more positive outlook on the world.
I mean, in my work and in the readings that I've done, like I was mentioning, Power and Progress, about the book I read recently, I think a lot of what I have processed or absorbed from these experiences is that while there are, while we're seeing geopolitical tensions, when we're still observing socioeconomic gaps, a lot of people living below the poverty line, etc. But we're also seeing a lot of actions being taken by development institutions and international organizations. So I think we should be hopeful positive about the prospects of the changes that are being implemented. So we talked about the SDGs together, right? They are in place. They were not there 10 years ago. And if we, what the question is then what we can do on our side. If we're passionate about a certain area, we want to specialize in that, we can do so and then try to pay our way into one of these settings to understand how to make a positive contribution that is already happening. It is taking time, but it's not that no one is moving and no one is acting. So I think that should reassure us to believe that we actually can make the world a better place. But again, it's going to take time and we need to be patient, which takes me back to what we were initially discussing, right? About being a patient, a resilient, and the perseverant.
Absolutely. Change doesn't happen overnight. And I think that a lot of people, including myself, get frustrated or caught up when we see issues in the world that haven't been immediately solved. And there are certainly some that have been problems for a long time that also haven't been solved. But, it's great connecting with people, especially in the professional world, who are really working hard to make change in the world and make the world a better place. So thank you for joining us. This was a really informative and interesting conversation. And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Carl. It's been my pleasure, and I look forward to connecting with you.